Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
Hello, welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast. My name is Galen Dahl, and here are the salient points from the weekly outlook to watch out for in the coming days. Leaders from the four Visegrad countries are set to convene in Prague on the 27th of February for a summit that has long been delayed. The gathering, previously hindered by security tensions, particularly Hungary's resistance to EU funds for Kyiv, and the delayed inclusion of Sweden in NATO, has now captured the spotlight. Breaking the deadlock, Orban has finally allowed for the substantial 50 billion euro package for Ukraine to be passed by the parliament, and on Monday, the 26th of February, Sweden became the 32nd nation in the NATO alliance after Budapest finally ratified their membership. Nevertheless, expect friction between Robert Fico from Slovakia and Viktor Orban from Hungary. Their pro-Russian narratives will be conflicting with the pro-Western voices of Prime Ministers Petr Fiala and Donald Tusk from Czech Republic and Poland, respectively. Farmers from across the EU are continuing their protests to block roads with a particular focus on Poland. Prime Minister Tusk is trying to repair relations with Kyiv, but Tusk declined an emotional plea from President Zelensky to hold a meeting at the border, where farmers are blocking checkpoints and emptied Ukrainian grain from the rail cars in raging Kyiv. Political dynamics intensified in Bulgaria as the scheduled rotation of the premiership between the two ruling parties approaches in early March. The foreign minister, Maria Gabriel of the Gerb Party, is set to take over from the current prime minister, Nikola Denkov. The ongoing debate between the two parties revolves around the selection of the next foreign minister. The separatist authorities in Transnistria, the breakaway region of Moldova, have announced a momentous Congress of Deputies set to convene on the 20th of February in the heart of this Russian-affiliated area. This historic assembly, the first of its kind in 18 years, holds the potential to reshape geopolitical landscapes, as it contemplates a vote to declare Transnistria an integral part of the Russian Federation. The looming decision also raises the stakes, as the region may seek Moscow's protective umbrella against the Moldovan government. A political showdown of extraordinary proportions is on the horizon. For more detailed analysis on the region, subscribe and receive our weekly outlook. Up next, stay tuned for my discussion with Wojciech Przybylski on his recent trip to Kyiv. So, Wojciech, you just returned from your trip to Kyiv. What were your impressions on the second anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion?
Yes, the meeting that I attended was Yalta European Summit, and I also took an opportunity to meet with a number of our fellows from the Future of Europe Fellowship, who are based in Kyiv. An impression of the city and the resilience is always amazing in Ukraine. Like upon previous travels, Ukrainians display in all of the cities a certain stoicism vis-a-vis the onslaught of Russian armies and the bombardments of their cities with rockets. You wouldn't sense the nervousness observed otherwise in many other countries when the issue of war is discussed, and many are already thinking whether to pack bags or go to the basements in case we are attacked. Life in Kyiv is going on, and at the same time, everybody is very feel and talk about very present issues that relate on one hand to the possibilities of the Russian army expanding the front lines and continuing after Avdiivka, after the West have the West collectively has failed Ukraine in supplying the ammunition and allowed Russian strategic advantage, especially in the communication field, not so much in the gains on the battlefront and territorial gains, because still they control up to 18% of the Ukrainian territory with significant troubles, we should say. And the discussion is also on the possibilities of expanding the manufacturing technological base of the industries in Europe, but specifically in Ukraine, that will enable the army of Ukraine to continue their successful recapturing of the territories currently occupied by Russia. And that, finally, is connected with the third point that is being discussed in the policy circles, but also with people on the streets or with our fellows, which is the model of growth and of a society, the kind of social economic model, because you're impressed by the vibrance, agility, kind of determination, you would say, but you can simply call it energy of the Ukrainian society and economy throughout these very challenging times. And yes, international support is so very much important. The Ukrainians are resilient also by their productivity, innovation, as they continue to produce also arms that are so important, sometimes pivotal, as we've seen in the last week, for hitting and sinking or downing many of the very advanced weaponry of in Russia. So these three topics of the disinformation, communication, kind of the and the strategic narrative of the West, which is often missing the point by saying that it's a war in Ukraine. It's a war on the West, on the collective West, and the battlefield is in Ukraine. The issue of the weapons and the necessity for very basic weapons like ammunition, along with advanced system, and the issue of recovery, building the promise of it, that these are very striking in the talks you may have in Kiev or in other places in Ukraine.
Okay, that's so do you think that there is an optimism that maybe this next year they'll be able to regain more territory, did you feel, like with your conversations with people? Or was it more of a sober analysis that it's going to be even kind of a longer trench?
I think the dominant feeling is that this year is going to be very difficult. It's already been difficult. But one of the most catchy phrases I heard during this event, during the meeting and the conference, was that when there was optimism of the last year about the counteroffensive, it was too much. The optimism was an overestimate. And today's pessimism is probably so widespread, also not in Ukraine, but around the world, about Ukraine's prospects, is again overblown. Because yes, they've been taking some hits, and Ukraine is in a worse position than we all hoped for sure. But they are prepared for a long struggle, long battle, along with our analysis that we've been publishing and talking about, you know, in the past couple of years with the reports on the war and the future of Europe. We have been and giving the estimate that this is going to be a long war, multi-annual effort that, well, in the end will bring peace. But Russia is not to be considered as an actor for any negotiations. I mean, negotiations and peace cannot be prescribed, cannot be designed, and needs to be fought for and has to be won.
Well, kind of on this note, last week you wrote an editorial, which there's a link beneath the podcast for everyone to kind of click on and read. Well, in that editorial, you kind of expressed our stance, but the editorial stance on Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine. But what's interesting, I think, in the beginning is you kind of take a more apologetic tone vis-a-vis Europe's relationship with Ukraine. Specifically, you kind of highlight the recent farmer protests that have been kind of popping up along many of the border crossings with Ukraine. My question to you is, how significant do you find these protests? And under what guise do you think it would be most helpful for people to understand the context and the potential maybe solution to end this kind of prolonged demonstration?
Absolutely, very relevant question, and something that I was faced immediately as a representative of the country that these protests are taking place, where these protests are taking place right now. And I think there is an element of disappointment that we are allowing for the protest to take the shape that is directly undermining the morale of the well-being, the psychological well-being of Ukrainians. And the reason for that is that we have allowed for these images to spread of grain put on the roads being destroyed by farmers who are protesting. Of course, we've seen very violent protests across Europe, and Europe has been not probably really shocked by images of grain from which we have, you know, the flour and then bread being destroyed because of the abundance of the resource on the European market. And Ukraine of today is also flourishing. It's booming in production of agriculture, but Ukrainians' identity is built on the memory of the Holodomor, of the genocidal policy of the USSR, under which Ukrainians were starved to death in order to and died in and hundreds of thousands, millions, who in the second and after the Second World War were simply exploited for the benefits of USSR, of the imperial policy of Moscow. Seeing these images hurt every Ukrainian friend that I met, journalists or policymakers or people I simply spoke to, and they asked about it because we have allowed for these images to to potentially divide our nations. But at the same time, when it came to the policy response, the assessments by Ukrainians of their own leadership in this challenge, they were taking a bit more distance position. I mean, the politics behind it and the efforts to solve this issue, they're treating with a grain of salt. When it comes to the strategic communication of their very own government, specifically Mr. Zelensky. So I haven't heard immediately anyone supporting Mr. Zelensky call for, you know, going to the border and talking over the border of the issue as if this was bringing any quick solution. But instead, I heard, and actually coming from the government, Minister Kaczka, responsible for agriculture and also negotiating with the Polish side the issue, that the expectation for this to be resolved between Poland and Ukraine, and probably, you know, when it comes to the blockade, other countries as well, is going to take time. He mentioned by the end of this year, do not expect this will be fully resolved. So in other words, saying that, yes, there will be sectoral and very difficult negotiations about specific interests. They will take time, and the government of Ukraine will not be essentially further pushing it, so to escalate also this political emotion. So this understanding of the complexity is also on the Ukrainian side.
I'm glad that there's more of a nuanced understanding than on all kind of sides. It's multifaceted. Well, I mean, the end of your editorial takes a more optimistic, should we say, view of the future, one where Ukraine is, it could be like a full member of Western institutions with like a robust kind of a recovery project behind after the war kind of comes to a close. Now, my question to you is kind of be more about what carrots do you think could be used to bring decision makers and policymakers maybe more urgently to the table to support Ukraine where they need to be supported so that the war can come to a close and for this kind of promise of the future?
I don't think any carrots are there really for bringing leaders to make what is needed, what is necessary, what will testify to the leadership of those who are in power today and in the near future. Primarily, this is about realization. What's their responsibility for their own nations? That is national interest of every nation member of NATO, EU, and collective West. Remember that Taiwan remembers about it. South Korea remembers about it. Japan remembers about it. New Zealand, Australia, the supporters of Ukraine are global. They are not as numerous as those who have been shying away from the support against imperialist Russia, but their substantive and collective response to the war is in their national interest. I cannot understand how Mr. Johnson in the U.S. Congress is still undercutting U.S. strategic interests. Russia is not fighting this war to capture Ukraine. They wouldn't care about Ukraine less that just one piece of land of a very vast country they already have. They are looking to undermine strategic U.S. interests to drive a wedge in the society. They've been doing so for many years before already, and they are looking to undercut U.S. ability to stand by its allies, by its commitments, by its leader. They're looking to undercut the commander-in-chief and his decisions and his leadership. And if they succeed, they win. And U.S. will lose credibility to every other ally in the world, which will cost dearly, first financially, and then in security terms, in American lives, because wars will be fought.
That's an excellent point. I mean, it is one that you can see how the conservatives in America are somewhat divided. I hate to say it, that the majority are kind of following Trump's line, which is echoing exactly what you just said with the Speaker Johnson. With what you said about U.S. allies specifically in the region, I think there is a regional component to this that we should discuss. And as this week, there's also the long-awaited V4 summit, which is occurring on Tuesday, the 27th of February. I think it's fitting to kind of ask you about some of the recent changes that we've witnessed there, and what could be some of the what we could potentially expect going forward over the coming months and years. More specifically, let's say after Hungary kind of finally allowed for the 50 billion euro package to pass the EU Parliament for support of Ukraine, and it promises again to ratify Sweden's membership in NATO. Is there a possibility for kind of a unified V4 approach on some of these issues related to security in Ukraine going forward? Or was this more of like a momentary blip?
There isn't going to be anytime soon the type of unity and common voice in EU affairs as we have seen on the migration question, which elevated the political position of V4 in the past. And for the time being, it's good. What the V4 is useful for today, and this is going to be tried over the summit and probably over the next years of the format, is to negotiate and persuade those who are members of the European Council, decision makers of one of the countries today, Hungary and Slovakia, notably taking pro-Russian positions in the challenge over Ukraine, to moderate their position, be more constructive, be more true to the origins of the Visegrad cooperation, which was uniformly pro-Western, peace-loving, even climate and energy security focus, which is really remarkable if you want to go back to the 1990s and the visionary points that were then inscribed in the declaration. And the V4 summits and the V4 cooperation may be used for moderating these most radical positions, trying to find common sense ahead of the summits of the EU when much more important decisions are being made. And in the current situation, I see there is a lot of posturing from Budapest, from Viktor Orban. There is this new posturing of Mr. Fico, who just before the summit, so a couple of days ago, announced that he is basically going fully supportive of the narrative, that is Moscow narrative in Europe about Ukraine. They will be facing two ardent supporters of Ukraine, Czechia and Poland. With the new government in Poland, the former Budapest-Warsaw axis is not working anymore. And the obvious new direction is what has worked in the past, before 2015. This is collaboration between Warsaw and Prague, because there is a strategic alignment when it comes to the security question, defense. Let's remember that General Pavel has miraculously found a way to generate or to find and to buy the existing ammunition for Ukraine. He announced that during the Munich Security Forum recently. And this is very much the line and the direction that the government of Donald Tusk wanted, to mobilize full support right now of the West for Ukraine. Secondly, and very importantly, these are the two most potent economies in Central Europe. It's about Polish GDP and Czech GDP plus their collected wealth. This is the most wealthy per capita nation in the region, which not only that they are wealthy, they are or productive and efficient, they are also having the biggest trade exchange between themselves and with Germany and with others. That clearly indicates that the two important tools, strategic tools for decision-making, for political consolidation, lie in these two capitals, and then their further relations with Bratislava and Budapest. What will emerge from that, we'll have to wait and see. The ambitions for the future of V4 have definitely scaled down after the takeover of the agenda by Viktor Orban and abandoning leadership position by Poland in V4 by Mr. Kaczyński and his prime minister, Mr. Morawiecki. But now we're going to see a new test of repositioning the format to something it has been also designed from the very beginning, to manage conflictual position of the neighbors in the larger context also of the EU.
Thank you, Wojciech. It's going to be fascinating to find out what kind of occurs in the summit this week. I want to thank our listeners, everyone, for chiming in. For the links to Wojciech's editorial as well as the weekly outlook, please just look below the description. And thank you very much. Once again, I'm Galen Dahl.
Wojciech Przybylski.
All right. And have a good evening and talk to you next week.